Good morning, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
We can.
Hello. My name is Janine Jansen. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Heinrich and Gabriella von Mende. As the court is aware, this is an insurance dispute between insureds and the insurer and the insurer's captured agent. The district court entered summary judgment in favor of the insurer and the agent, and we believe that summary judgment was improper because evidence presented to the district court created genuine issues of material fact for trial. This court may recall that in a case called Graff versus Swendra Agency, it is 800 Northwest 2nd, 112, Minnesota, 2011, the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized that a claim may exist against an agent for negligent procurement of insurance, regardless of whether the carrier is liable. And that case, Graff versus Swendra, in fact, included a captured agent, much like the Stanky respondents are here. Your Honor, in the district court, the submissions, including State Farm's own submissions, showed that its agent bound coverage for Heinrich von Mende, who had title to a vehicle, a new vehicle that the couple had purchased, and then failed to place that coverage as bound. And I'm specifically referring to the affidavit of Tamara Rollins, which was filed on May 23rd, 2017, Exhibit 6. It's an email exchange, and we do have I brought a copy because it's not in the addendum. So if the court wishes to, I've left those with the clerk. But in that exchange, Mr. Bush, who was acting on behalf of the Jerry Stanky Insurance Office, the agent, offered coverage to Heinrich on certain terms, 100 medical, 300 medical per occurrence, et cetera. And Mr. von Mende wrote back to Mark Bush and said, thanks for the added info. I will go with the 100, 300, 100 for the Nissan at 115 and the changes to the Sonata for a new total of 62, 68. Please let me know if there is anything else I need to do in order to finalize these changes.
Does the record indicate the ownership of the replaced vehicle? I believe it was a Tucson.
I believe that the record does indicate that the ownership, the title for the replaced vehicle was in Mr. von Mende's name, not Ms. von Mende's name.
So that's the same as before. So why would the agent believe that the arrangement, I mean, that's the same as with the new vehicle, and the old vehicle.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know the title of the old vehicle.
Oh, we don't know.
I don't know the title of the old vehicle.
How long, let's assume that you're correct for the sake of this question as to the binding of the binding, oral binding from the oral communication and the email exchange between the agent and your client. How long does that binding last?
If I may clarify, Your Honor, it is actually a written binder because it's in an email, but stepping back from that, it would have bound the coverage through February 23rd I'm trying to remember which year it was. I think it's 2015. Do I have the right year? It might have been.
I'm going to point you to some case law that's not in the briefs. There are a couple of cases that are cited and relied upon by the cases that are cited in the parties' briefs, and that's the Coy Vista case and the Rommel case. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those. In your research, you may have found them. But those cases continue to be viable, apparently. They're cited regularly as to what happens in a binding. And in the Coy Vista case, the Supreme Court, and I'll just give you the West Reporter, I think it's a 530 Northwest Reporter. It's Coy Vista versus Bankers Merchants Fire Insurance. But in that case, the Supreme Court says, if a policy was issued, it would, of course, supersede the preliminary contract. So the court there is describing the binding as preliminary. Mm-hmm. And it goes further and says, until it was issued or the application was rejected and the applicant notified so that he would have an opportunity to get insurance elsewhere. And the court goes on and says that's the end of the binding. So the whatever the contract is that results from this agent communication is a preliminary contract that lasts only until either one of two things happens. The policy is issued superseding it, mm-hmm. or there's an indication from the insurer that the policy as assumed in this binding doesn't exist. And the same occurs in the Rommel case. Mm-hmm. Have you found any cases that would dispute that those premises?
No, that's certainly the law.
So in this case, you're saying that your client had a contract for insurance with your client as the named insurer or named insured for the new vehicle, the Pathfinder.
Mm-hmm.
But within a day or two of that communication or binding, there was a declaration sent to your client indicating that your client's understanding must have been wrong because the Sonata included, or the policy that covers the Sonata includes only the Sonata, not the new Pathfinder. Correct me if I'm wrong about my understanding of the facts or about how these cases would apply to end the binding, the preliminary contract at that time.
I would dispute whether the communication clarifies that the Pathfinder was not on the Sonata's policy.
Well, the declaration says the vehicle lists the vehicles on that policy, and I didn't see the Pathfinder mentioned. Am I correct on the record?
Well, except that this is an agreement between the two of them to insure the Pathfinder, and the subsequent policy that would be issued would be the policy on the Pathfinder. And what happened here was, in fact, State Farm sends a declaration sheet to Gabriella, who is not the person making changes to her policy.
I'll pause you for a moment. I thought your argument was that your client had an understanding that the Pathfinder would be added to
yes.
the Sonata policy.
Yes.
The declaration as to this, as to the, to that vehicle does not include the Pathfinder, and that declaration was received by your client or was sent by State Farm immediately after this communication. So starting from that point.
But my client always had coverage for the Sonata, so this is not sufficient to tell him you don't have coverage for your Pathfinder. Under these circumstances.
Sufficient to tell him that the Pathfinder is not included on the Sonata policy.
Because the conversation that he has had with Mr. Bush has bound coverage for the Pathfinder.
No, I understand.
He needs
that's
to get the policy
argument.
For the Pathfinder.
But if that's a preliminary contract, according to the case law, and then he receives communication, your client Heinrich receives communication from the insurer that the Pathfinder has not been added after this conversation with the agent. Nevertheless, has not been added to the Sonata policy. Why doesn't that fall under the analysis of the two cases I mentioned?
Because we're still talking about the policy that is issued with respect to the Pathfinder. And so, put it this way, if that was all that was ever issued, would we conclude, let's say that we don't have Gabriella in the mix here, he calls to ask for coverage for his new Pathfinder. The agent says, okay, I've bound coverage for your new Pathfinder, then sends a deck sheet that doesn't include the new Pathfinder. Would we let the carrier off the hook when its agent fails to follow through on the requested coverage?
I thought that was the analysis. The preliminary contract lasts only until the policy was issued or the applicant is notified that the preliminary contract, whatever, is rejected.
Well, there's nothing. I apologize, Your Honor. I didn't mean to stop over.
No.
There's nothing about that suggests that his application was rejected. So the only thing that it can be is somehow telling him, hey, by the way, for whatever reason, we're not writing this coverage. And he
right.
at this
right.
moment,
let's assume
though.
So.
Excuse me?
Let's assume that's so. That's, I guess that's my question. If he learns from the insurer that whatever he was told by the agent, the insurer is not writing the coverage as he understood it, and now he's on notice to do something, to pay money, to get insurance somewhere else, to recontact the agent, to get clarification. I'm trying to get a sense of why that's not sufficient notice for your client to realize that whatever understanding he thought he had, the insurer is not following through with his understanding.
If that was this court's basis for letting State Farm off the hook, fine. But that's not a basis to let the agent off the hook, because the agent has made a miscommunication to the insured, has made a binding agreement to bind coverage for the insured and failed to do it as requested. So that is, part of the problem here is that the district court dismissed both State Farm and the captured agent on the same theory, which was the theory applicable to State Farm, but not to the agent. Here we have an agent who has made a representation to the insured about what that agent will bind, then fails to bind it.
So what's the harm to your client?
He doesn't have coverage for a car he thought he was going to have coverage for.
Right, but if he didn't, assume that the analysis that we just talked about applies throughout the whole case. That is, your client is on notice that whatever he understood from the agent is not something that State Farm is following through with. Why at that moment going forward isn't your client able to mitigate the breach, to cure the negligence?
Well,
why are there damages? How is your client prejudiced?
The practical effect is that insureds rely on their insurance agents. And so what you're asking, I think, Your Honor, what you're asking to do here, and the two cases that you described, I don't know them specifically. They don't surprise me. It is the general law. It's the general law that if I go get a binder for insurance in Minnesota and I say, hey, you know, I want my coverage for a Minnesota, a vehicle that is garaged here in Minnesota, that I'm going to have Minnesota law apply to it. The insurance policy then comes to me, and I look at it, and I fail to process the fact that some aspect of Minnesota law is something I don't like or whatever. I don't get to then try to pick apart the policy and say, wait a minute, this isn't what you told me I would get in the binder. In the binder, it didn't have these limitations on coverage. That is how those cases arise. Here we have a situation where the coverage is simply not bound at all. So I don't know how Mr. Von Mende is supposed to know as he's standing there and merely gets a confirmation that he still has coverage on his Sonata, that he does not have coverage on the Pathfinder. He is expecting that the agent will follow through. And as a matter of fact, the district court heard evidence presented both by Mr. and Mrs. Von Mende, also through documents that State Farm presented, as well as Mr. Dahl, who was district court counsel that was just copying matters produced in discovery. And then finally, the Von Mendes had an expert who had reviewed the relevant facts regarding the binder and had an opinion that it violated the standard of care for the agent to have failed to alert Mr. Von Mende to the fact that in order to have the coverage that he clearly wanted to have and that was bound, he needed to fill out certain forms.
Isn't it true that the insurance company sent documents to Ms. Von Mende that would have informed her that the Nissan was under her policy?
Yes. Communications were sent to Ms. Von Mende, but of course that's a policy that Heinrich Von Mende and Ms. Von Mende are expecting will be canceled. So to get a notice that your policy is going to be canceled is hardly surprising when that is in fact what you asked to do.
Wasn't there also declarations identifying the Nissan Pathfinder as on her policy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I got confused.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. You're asking,
receive a document that after the change that indicated that she was the insured on a policy covering the Nissan?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's true.
And so what's the relevance? I mean, I think It's easier to see more direct relevance to the claim against State Farm, but how is that relevant to the claim against the agency?
Those communications are coming from State Farm. They have nothing to do with the agency itself and its agreement with Mr. Von Mende.
But together, the two of them, I mean, let's just, you know, I think both respondents are arguing generally that they received mailings. If they had read all of their mailings, they would have known that something was contrary to what they had intended based upon what they say their intentions are. And does that defeat the claim against the agency?
I see that I'm out of time. Do you mind if I answer
your
question?
Please answer.
I don't think so, because we have two different insureds, two different policy numbers, two different people here.
They're married.
Do we import notice
And when he called the agency on the phone, he purported to speak on her behalf. Is that a given?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that notice sent to her telling her that her policy is about to be canceled would give him notice that that she has to pay additional funds on her policy. This is, to me, either State Farm can have two separate policies, and I apologize if I need to step down, I will. Either they can have two separate policies with two separate policy numbers and treat the insureds as entirely separate, or they can treat them as a married couple and have one policy. State Farm had two policies here, and it basically tried to import an obligation undertaken by one insured to another insured and then expected them to understand how that had been sorted out.
I had a sense that the choice to have separate policies and separate named insureds was the preference of the Von Mendes. Am I correct about that?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think the record is entirely clear on that, because there is discussion about how whether the policies had to be issued under State Farm's internal underwriting rules. And this is in some of the depositions that are attached to the affidavits in below. But there is discussion of whether the underwriting standards required that the auto policies be issued with the named insured as the owner of the owner of title on the vehicle.
Thank you, Ms. Jansen.
Thank you.
You will have an additional 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. So who goes first, State Farm or the Stanky firm?
I think that should be good.
Is
that loud enough? I'm usually not accused of being quiet. Kate McBride here on behalf of State Farm Fire and Casualty. What we heard just now was that the Von Mendes did indeed receive the declaration pages for both the Sonata and the Pathfinder, and those declarations showed what was insured and that they replaced they amended the old policies. They don't dispute that. They were sent a balance due notice. They don't dispute they received and ignored that.
Well, when you say they, I think the argument is that these are separate. The statute requires notice of cancellation to go to the insured. Heinrich Von Mende asserts that he should have been the insured based on communications he had. And there was an understanding that any communication, therefore, that would go to Gabriella would have no relevance because they expected her policy to be terminated. So it's kind of reading between the lines. Why bother even opening that? Seems to be the argument. And so I think that's the, you know, I'm a little bit troubled by the idea that even though they're married, the assumption would be that notice to one would necessarily be notice to the other, even if in the practical scheme of things, that's usually the way it works.
Lots of multi-part answer to that question.
Go
so,
for it.
First of all, as we heard today, there's no dispute that each one of them, in their name, got mailed a declaration page, and yet when he got that, he didn't say, "Hey, agent, why isn't the Pathfinder on here?" And when she got the balance due notice and her deck page, "Hey, I'm not supposed to be the insured here. What's going on? I don't know a darn thing."
Am I correct on the timing that declaration notice came immediately after
yes,
the conversation?
Yes, within a day it was sent out. And I think it's interesting, the exhibit that was of the focus of the argument here this morning seems to actually undercut their argument, because the email there, that's Exhibit 6, says, Mr. Von Mende says, I'll go with the 100, 300, 100 for the Nissan at 115, meaning the price of the premium per month, and the changes to the Sonata for the new total, seemingly indicating he understood these were two different policies. And that
a payment would be due to...
For each one, sure. That there would be a... Because he decreased on the Sonata, there was going to be a refund, but there was going to be an increase on the new Nissan policy. But I want to get to really what I think makes all of this almost irrelevant, and that is, even if there were some kind of fact issue, which I don't believe there is, as to whether the Pathfinder should be on the Sonata policy because of the notice that they had and the policy already issued, as Your Honor just set forth, that Pathfinder would have only been subject to the terms of that policy that appellant's claim created a binder. The Sonata policy was only effective, the policy that was supposed to attach as a binder, to 223.16.
Yeah, the problem with that argument, though, I think, and that's where I think the whole who's named on the policy matters. It's true that the policy would have expired on February 23rd, but that the statute requires any termination based upon non-payment or non-renewal based upon non-payment to have notice sent to the insured. And according to the appellant's argument, the insured, based upon this binder, must have been Heinrich and not Gabrielle. I think that's the argument.
I think you're right, but I think the problem with that is that with this record, and they had the burden coming forward as the non-moving party, there's no evidence of any Sonata policy going forward after 223, and that's the policy it's supposed to be attached to, sort of bound to. There's no evidence of any Sonata policy after 223.
They're arguing that the Sonata policy is... The Pathfinders are one and the same because of the binder, and that cannot be terminated except for notice given to the actual named insured.
That would be true for the next policy period, but there's no evidence in the record of any policy covering the Sonata after the 23rd at all. And there's no evidence that they paid for any of the next 6 months of policy for the Sonata. They needed to come forward with that, and there's certainly, let alone, no evidence of any coverage for the Pathfinder. What we have here is a story that State Farm was supposed to put this policy on the Sonata. They were supposed to cancel and refund the money from the Tucson, and that they didn't, so all the money that was paid for the Tucson, unearned premiums come back, they have this new, more expensive car, and they don't even have to pay the $81.94, the additional, until the next policy period. So essentially, what they're saying is State Farm, these agents, told them they could have this coverage for these 6 months that ends on February 23rd for free. But even if that could be believed, even if that were enough to create a genuine issue of material fact, what we don't have is any evidence that $81.94 was ever paid before the 24th, that there was any payment for any policy after the 23rd. And so if it's bound to this policy, that policy, the only evidence in the record is that policy ended on the 23rd. There's no evidence of anything going forward.
Can a policy end for non-payment if the named if the insured is not given notice of the non-renewal based upon non-payment?
So we're not arguing that the Sonata was canceled for non-payment going forward. We're simply saying there's no evidence that Pathfinder or the Sonata, that there was any coverage after the 23rd. It's simply not in the record, and it was their burden to come forward with that. But more importantly, binders are intended to be preliminary contracts for present insurance, not future policy periods. This policy period that they claim it attached to was ended on the 23rd.
I'm going to make you change lanes for a moment to address something that was a little troubling to me in the district court, the carte blanche rejection of affidavits based upon what the district court described as third-party presentation. And I recognize it's not normal. It seems inartful, maybe not very careful drafting of an affidavit, but I'm trying to imagine if Bob Dole were to write an affidavit and refer to himself in the third person. How is it as a matter of law that a district court can disregard an affidavit and strike it completely on the notion that some, not all, but some of the representations are offered in the third person as opposed to the first person? Is there any law to support that or logic?
The law goes to 56005 that talks about
personal knowledge.
Personal knowledge, demonstrate competence and personal knowledge.
Why do we assume that a person who's speaking in the third person is necessarily lacking in personal knowledge? It seems like that's what the district court did.
Sure. Two parts of it. First, I think what troubled the court was the word for word, it looks like it came right out of the memorandum of law, that it was an attorney's crafting rather than a statement of personal knowledge. But secondly,
so what? Lawyers craft affidavits all the time, and their parties are responsible to read and sign them only if they're accurate on personal knowledge. Why would it matter if it's cut and pasted?
Sure. And my second point was just that. In any event, the court said, even if I didn't, these affidavits don't overcome the fact that there is no coverage on February 24th.
No, I understand that, but your brief defends the district court's striking of the affidavit, and I didn't understand.
It's my opinion that the court was correct that they don't evidence personal knowledge or competence. We have, especially when you have the husband and wife saying exactly the same thing. But be that as it may, that does not, those affidavits, for the reasons I had just articulated, do not extend coverage to 224. That policy was issued. They had the obligation to come forward and say, hey, where's the Pathfinder on the Sonata? Or, I don't owe this money. I got a letter from State Farm addressed to me, Gabriella, and I don't owe this money. They have some obligation. They're saying they have no personal responsibility for coming forward. They called on 12-9 to get insurance cards. Why didn't they call and say they didn't have them? The fact is that they ignored this, and they ignored correspondence coming from State Farm. But even if we don't have a binder extending ad infinitum, binders aren't intended to that. So even if you buy their argument and put aside the fact that they never came forward, that binder was supposed to be on that one policy. And there is no evidence of any policy going forward after, it's nothing in the record of any policy going forward or any coverage after the 23rd. And that, I see my time is up, and I think that is the thing that they cannot overcome. And for that reason, there's no coverage, and the court properly dismissed. Thank you.
Well, your time's up. I did ask you quite a few questions and take up some of your time, so I wanted to make sure if either of my colleagues had any follow-up questions that you have the opportunity.
I did not.
Nope. All right.
Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you. Counsel for the other respondent, Stanky Firm. That's the record for the height of the platform.
It hides my rotund physique here. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Steve Viltoft. I'm representing the three other named, originally third-party defendants and now respondents, Mr. Bush, Nash, and Mr. Stanky, who's present here in the courtroom. I'm going to call them the Stanky Agency. I want to answer one question that Your Honor, Justice Ross, had at the in questioning other counsel here. The reason why Gabriella Von Mendy was designated as the named insured on the policy that was originally on the Tucson and then transferred onto the Pathfinder is because that's how Gabriella Von Mendy set it up when she applied for the insurance in the first place. Mr. Stanky and his other employees don't care who's a named insured, but they have to follow the wishes of their insureds when they sign up for the insurance.
Does the record tell us whether Gabriella was, it seems clear that the Pathfinder was owned exclusively by Gabriella, or at least she's the title holder exclusively, and Heinrich is not on the title, I think, on the Pathfinder. Was that the case also with the Tucson?
The Tucson, first of all, State Farm doesn't ask for the title cards when they insure the vehicles.
I understand that.
But it was represented to State Farm that Gabriella Von Mendy owned the Tucson, and then Heinrich Von Mendy called up the agency and said, I bought for her birthday a replacement to update that vehicle, and that's why the Pathfinder was purchased.
Does the record indicate that it was that she owned the Tucson?
We don't know. It's okay. Not in the record, and State Farm was not informed one way or the other. It's undisputed that Heinrich said, I bought it for a birthday gift for my wife to replace the older vehicle, and it's a new vehicle. And it's undisputed that there was a discussion that the premiums would go up because it's a newer vehicle. That's undisputed.
The named insured on the Tucson, isn't that in the record?
That is in the record, and that is Gabriella Von Mendy. Now, Your Honors, this is really a pretty simple case. For 44 years, car insurance has been mandatory in Minnesota if you have a car, since January 1st, 75. The owner has a responsibility if you buy a car, you inherit a car, you replace a car, to make sure you have insurance on it. Banks writing loans on vehicles require that you have proof of insurance. Dealerships don't let you drive off the lot unless you have proof of insurance. The fact of the matter is that this family, for whatever reason, and I'm not bashing them, just telling you, for whatever reason, they have not been responsible in handling their insurance needs. For example, the first renewal period after a year on these policies, they didn't pay until the very last day until they were contacted and said, hey, your policies are about to expire. You guys better pay this. They ran into the office and paid it. Then they replaced the vehicle as this birthday gift, which we just discussed a moment ago, and then didn't inform State Farm for 10 weeks, which means...
Now we understand all of that,
yeah.
But that's not relevant to the legal issues, is it, if they were negligent in their previous...
Well, it's relevant when Judge Street is making a determination that there's no facts to support these allegations, and it's relevant, I think, to the track record of what's going on here in the course of conduct. They come in December and say, oh, by the way, we bought this vehicle in September, and they're like, the agents are like, holy smokes, you've been going around naked. We better get this taken care of, and they bind the policy for 12:01 a.m. on the following day, and they get that straightened out. That was done. There is no evidence in the record, and Judge Street confirmed this, to support this allegation that Heinrich Von Mendy told State Farm that he wanted to take over to be the named insured under Gabriella Von Mendy's policy. There's nothing. Even that email that counsel handed out this morning, you can't take the pronoun I.
I thought the argument was that there was a phone conversation and the emails, and you construe those things.
Yeah. There's simply nothing to corroborate that, and that's what Judge Street said. There's just no evidence of that in the record. And
that the affidavit referred to phone conversations. Am I wrong about that?
They claim there was a phone conversation, but nothing in the contemporaneous emails reflect anything about that discussion, and the deck sheet that was sent out didn't change that at all.
As a matter of summary judgment, why would that matter?
Because
there's no corroborating documents if you have an affidavit representing an oral conversation.
Well, I think it's because there's evidence here circling back to our issue about the importance of insurance coverage here. It has to be in writing for it to be a legal binding in this. You can't just call up your agency, I just bought a Rolls Royce, I want coverage, and then leave it at that. There has to be something communicated in writing. There has to be money issued to bind the coverage to change from the preliminary contract stage to an actual insurance coverage on the vehicle. They never communicated in writing, and is undisputed on the record from the testimony of the agency personnel that you cannot just call up and say, hey, change the policy from my wife to me. It's not allowed because the policy has residual value, and you can't just take property from another individual. Or even if you are married, you can't call up and say, hey, change this policy that has value from my wife to me. There's paperwork that has to be filled out to change that. They never requested that paperwork. It was never discussed. And there is no such paperwork because she remained the insured of the policy. So this whole named insured thing is simply a canard as an excuse for why they didn't open up their mail and review it. It's interesting that 2 days before they get the premium renewal notice, they cash the refund check for the drop in coverage on the Sonata. So when they get a check in the mail, they open up their mail, and it's addressed to Gabriella Von Mendy. They open that mail up. They don't open up the mail that says they owe the insurance premium. And the judge to street was very troubled by the fact that they never denied they got the premium notice.
So it's not so hard to understand why the mailings that were sent to them are significant for the claim against State Farm. But
yes.
But it seems it might be different for the claim against the agency. I mean, let's say, hypothetically, if the agency did not do what what was requested. The agency, if the agency was negligent, is it the theory that they had an opportunity to catch the mistake and that was their duty to do so before the accident occurred?
They had that duty. Furthermore, Your Honor,
is that your argument, your theory?
That's part of it. But the other argument is that State Farm didn't do this spontaneously. State Farm Corporate didn't do this spontaneously. The reason why these documents were issued was because the agent did do his job and communicated the information that had to be.
Well, there's a dispute about that, I think. But
there is no dispute that the documents were sent out and the documents themselves were proper.
I mean, there's a dispute about whether the agency carried out the express directive by Heinrich von Mende and was negligent in doing so.
And we're saying the record is that it would have been impossible and illegal for the Stanky agency to do what he claims he said he did over the phone. He cannot change that, transfer that policy without her consent in writing. It'd be illegal for him to do that under Minnesota law. And therefore, you can't assume that my agent would have done something illegal to save their coverage.
Mike, I'm sorry. No. I'll just re-ask my question. My question is whether the mailings that were sent and whether their receipts of the mailings that were sent are a defense to the claim against the agency.
Yes, and directly and indirectly, because they indirectly established that the agent did his job. Because the only way that those documents get issued by State Farm is if the agent communicates to State Farm to issue those documents. And the fact that they were issued properly and legally under the law reflects that the Stanky agency did what they were supposed to do and were legally obligated to do. Your Honor had a question?
I just want to ask Judge, to narrow a bit, Judge Johnson's question. So if, and I'm just speaking hypothetically here, if this court was to say, look, we think whether these conversations took place is a question of fact, not appropriate for summary judgment, and the notices under the plaintiff's, under the theory of the case, to Gabriella, you know, those shouldn't count because, you know, on summary judgment, he wanted the binding with him. But, so what we're down to then, under that theory, would be, it's just this declaration notice to Heinrich, on December 10th, it's the Sonatas on your policy, and it doesn't include the Pathfinder, okay? So that would be the one, if we're saying, yeah, but that one, that's to him. How does that address the agency? Does that save the agency on summary judgment or only State Farm?
Well, it isn't just the deck sheet. It's also the premium notice that was sent out saying you owe money on the Nissan that was addressed to Gabriella. She has an obligation to open that up, too.
Under their theory of the case, of appellant's theory of the case, if we follow that a bit, you say, well, what goes to Gabriella shouldn't matter because the oral request, the oral agreement that's set out here, alleged here, is to change the is to have a binder under Sonata binder include the Nissan.
Then we go back to Justice Ross's position here. It's an oral agreement. It's not binding. It's preliminary. State Farm's objective manifestations were that we still considered Gabriella von Mende to be the named insured under the Nissan Pathfinder policy, which succeeded the Tucson policy under the same policy period.
But as to the negligence claim, against your client, you're saying, well, the agency couldn't have done what was allegedly asked of your clients, but an average insurer, insured wouldn't know what the law is, what the agency can and can't do. And so I think the argument is that whatever your client could have done under the law differs from what your client did, which was to make a promise to include the Pathfinder on the Sonata policy. And so if that's so, would you agree that that's negligence? And if it is, I'm curious about your answer as to whether the Sonata declaration, going back to Judge Jessen's question, does the Sonata declaration cure it? If so, how?
It's difficult for me to argue something that I know to be untrue, first of all. I mean, I know that...
Hypothetical.
Yeah, I understand it's hypothetical, so it's difficult for me to address that because it just never happened. But assuming, arguendo, that it is what happened...
It is that it did happen, and a conversation would have revealed it, and therefore it has to go to a fact finder to determine whether it did or didn't have it.
Yeah.
So that's a dispute. So anybody's position about, well, I don't believe this is real, it couldn't have happened that way, I think is the argument. That's the problem. District court judges can't make those decisions.
Right. And so I think, again, we go to your original questions you asked of appellant's counsel, and that is, it's a preliminary binder, and once there's objective evidence that State Farm has not agreed to this preliminary agreement, the deal's off. There is no change of the coverage to Heinrich von Mendy. I would also add, Your Honor, that irrespective under any construction of the facts as they want to present them, there's still no coverage beyond February 23rd. There can't be.
Right, that helps State Farm, but I think Judge Johnson's question is as to the agency.
Yeah.
So if the reason they don't have any coverage after the 23rd is because of an inartful conversation between your client and the insureds, then I'm, again, going back to Judge Jessen's question, then does the declaration cure any liability to your client? If so, how?
I believe it does because it is now objective evidence that the preliminary contract that they believe from their affidavits as their side of the conversation is not being followed by State Farm and accepted by State Farm, that we're transferring the named insured from Gabriella to Heinrich von Mendy.
And your client's not responsible and liable for that due to negligence because?
Because he couldn't do it legally. There's undisputed evidence in the record that Mr. Stanky cannot unilaterally change the policy from Gabriella to Heinrich's name because it is a vested property right that Gabriella has, and he can't just give it to Heinrich because he calls up on the phone. It can't be done.
Well, thank you. We've kept you here longer than you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Sorry.
5 minutes. No, you shouldn't apologize. We were curious, and we're probing you. So
thank you
for being attentive to our questions. Counsel for appellant, you have rebuttal time if you'd like to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to clarify an issue that is a false statement of the record here. I'm guessing it was inadvertent, but I think State Farm and I don't know if the agency made the same argument, but in fact, Gabriella and Heinrich renewed all of their policies with State Farm after February 23rd of 2016.
After the accident?
Yes. In fact, Gabriella and Heinrich paid the $81 difference on the day of the accident they paid that to the Stanky agency, which then issued a renewal. I think it's called a reinstatement notice, and that's on page R9 of the respondent's appendix.
The reinstatement was effective the next day, the following day, right?
Correct. Yes, that's how State Farm processed it. But in addition to that,
what was the misstatement? I thought the argument they were making was that after February 23rd, there was no insurance, and
because,
obviously not until the reinstatement. But
I apologize, Your Honor, because Heinrich and Gabriella also purchased the subsequent 6-month policy period. And in fact, I don't know that the policy.
That was after the accident.
After the accident, but the effective dates for the Sonata, for example, would have been from for both of them, would have been from the 24th on. And the only reason it wasn't being set at the 24th on for the Pathfinder was because that was the date of the accident and they weren't going to cover a loss in progress, I'm assuming.
You mean the 25th?
The 24th.
The accident was on the 24th.
That's right.
I thought the reinstatement was effective the following day, the 25th.
That may be true for the Pathfinder, the policy as issued.
At RA9, I think I see that.
Yes, Your Honor. But also in the record here, at Exhibit Heinrich's affidavit of 11-15-17, Exhibit 7, it's a communication back and forth between Heinrich and the Stanky agency canceling their policies effective 8/23/16. So they did continue with the policies, and they then canceled them when they moved on to a different carrier. And this is something I think that becomes very relevant when you look at what the agency's version of facts is here, because it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. The agency accepted payment, and I realize we're not arguing for summary judgment here. I think there's a fact dispute. But what the agency did here does not make sense if the agency understood everything exactly the way it says it did. It accepted that payment, and attempted to reinstate the policy for Gabriella. It then went on and placed, and so it when it placed new coverage for the Pathfinder, it places new coverage on a vehicle that is totaled. There is absolutely no reason to place coverage on a totaled vehicle that isn't drivable, can't have any further property loss. Why did they even accept this money, both the $81 and then the whatever amount was the premium for the go-forward basis? Why did they accept this money? Because they were trying to cure something that they knew they had messed up. And that is consistent. I'm sorry, Your Honor, were you going to?
But your clients went and got it reinstated for Gabriella, which is inconsistent with your theory that it was really for Heinrich, right?
Well, at that point, what are you going to do? You've come into your agency. They've told you, you told them you wanted to put the policy in your name. They issued it, you find out later, in Gabriella's name. And all you want to do is try to make sure that you've got coverage and try to fix this problem, which, by the way, according to both Gabriella and Heinrich, the agency told them, and this is a disputed fact, obviously, the agency told them, we made a mistake. Mark Bush made a mistake. So everything that the agency...
The mistake was, to be clear, the accepting the funds for this, for insuring the total vehicle, that was the mistake, right? Not...
No,
what
no.
What are you saying the record says the mistake is?
The mistake was in failing to put the policy, to put the coverage on Heinrich's policy. They had placed it on Gabriella's policy, which was not what Heinrich had requested. And that's why they then gave him the form that should have been given to him by Mark Bush back in the day.
You're saying that there's an admission that the intent was to add Gabriella to Heinrich's policy on the Sonata? I didn't see that in the record.
No, I think there was an admission. My understanding of the both of Heinrich's and Gabriella's affidavits, and I see that my time is out, so may I finish?
Yes, please.
Heinrich's and Gabriella's affidavit said that Mr. Bush had by then left the agency, and that I think it was Mr. Natch, I may be mispronouncing his name, told them that Mark Bush had made a mistake when he placed the policy on Gabriella's policy as opposed to Heinrich's, which had been requested, because what he should have done was send them the form that would have released credit or whatever it was. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your briefing in this matter. The case, the appeal is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you for your arguments, and thank you for enduring our questions that pushed you over the time limit. That is the last case on for our oral argument. Oh, I take it back. We have one more case for oral argument, but that will be presented in interactive television, and we are therefore in recess until that's set up.